Hey, what's up, guys? So this is a podcast with Milan, who was previously a machine learning engineer and has shifted into the field of neuromodulation. Neuromodulation is like manipulating your brain using ultrasound waves or transcranial magnetic stimulation. And so we talk about the future of neuromodulation and the most important tools needed to develop this field. One note, I apologize if the audio isn't perfect. I'm still figuring out the best way to record these remote podcasts, but otherwise, let's get into it.
Now is the time to take risk.
So Milan, hey, how's it going? Thank you for being on the podcast.
One other thing we should have done in the preamble, I guess, I don't know if you edit these things. It depends on which parent you ask, but it's either pronounced Milan or if you're European, you know, I usually say.
I was going to ask, but you didn't correct me when we were talking about when I said it earlier.
That is my fault. I'm so used to it. People just kind of make their own pronunciation up. I really don't mind. But my dad's Croatian and says Milan, and my mom like Americanized it to Milan with Dylan. Don't ask me how that happened, but they like didn't even say it the same way for almost my whole life. And then just recently, they seem to have been slowly converging. So
what's the convergence pronunciation?
I think my dad is caving. He's like slowly he's slowly going to Milan. So, you know, Who knows what the right answer is, but yeah.
Okay. You know, if you want, give just a little bit of background on yourself. You were previously in machine learning, and then now you're interested in neuromodulation. Could you just like talk about your background and how you got to where you are now?
Yeah. So I guess the potted career history, I started off in undergrad working in chemistry, mainly because I thought I couldn't do math or computer science. I just had bad experiences with them growing up. And by bad experiences, I mean like I was bad at them. And then, yeah, slowly worked my way from synthetic chemistry to computational chemistry. And became a software engineer and then went to grad school to do a PhD in machine learning. Well, originally when I applied, I thought I would be doing it in quantum computing, but then realized by the time I showed up at Caltech that machine learning was what I wanted to do. Did a kind of a weird PhD. Oh, go ahead.
Why did you choose machine learning over quantum?
Partly that I had come to appreciate that even though I love math as a consumer of ideas, I'm not particularly productive as a mathematician. And there's good like engineering work to be done in quantum for sure too. But the program I was in was like the computer science side, like very much theoretical. My advisor at Caltech, actually, is a quantum cryptographer, Vidic, who's an absolute genius and utterly wonderful person, was just like, hey, do whatever you want. I have a ton of funding from all the various people who care about the stuff that he does and just needed to spend it on someone. So my advisor was a quantum cryptographer, but I actually did machine learning. And anyway, I did a kind of bizarre PhD where I did 2 years of normal grad school, realized I did not want to work in academia, went on sort of indefinite leave from Caltech and joined Amazon Web Services as a researcher and worked there for a couple of years and then took what I had published and went back to Caltech, stapled it together and called it a thesis. So snuck away with the letters, but it wasn't really a traditional PhD. And then I worked for a small molecule drug discovery company called Postera. They were in YC Winter 20. I joined them as their first employee last year and spent the whole pandemic being a nomadic machine learning guy on his laptop. So that's all.
And then did you recently leave or are you still there and just working on the ultrasound neuromodulation in your free time?
Right. I forgot that part. Yeah. So then I ended up leaving. It was very bittersweet. I love the company and the team, but I left to pursue other stuff in the space of neuromodulation in like May. And then I've been just doing this independent kind of road mapping market landscape analysis and learning the field on my own since then. And also doing some like consulting and stuff on the side. But
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was reading your GitHub about all the neuromodulation like factors that you were in, but you also mentioned that you're most interested in ultrasound. Why are you, can you maybe talk about the types of neuromodulation and then why you're most interested in ultrasound?
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, so no one should take my advice on this because I'm very new to the area, but the list you're referring to was just kind of me almost like putting together a syllabus for myself. Okay, so I guess I should say one of the main motivators for me to go out of machine learning and AI, besides the fact that I thought it was crowded and I didn't feel like I had a lot of contributions to make, was my interest in basically, I think it's what motivates me is there should be tools for people to fix their brains in whatever way they think that they need fixing, whether that's, you know, curing chronic pain or depression or, you know, helping people become more empathetic or, you know, cognitive enhancement, whatever it is. I just think that that's an incredibly important problem to work on. being an outsider to biology and neuroscience, I originally was like, oh, cool. How do you fix brains? Drugs fix brains, right? So let's go work in biotech and drug discovery. And I was super lucky to find the startup that I worked at and learned a ton. And I love that the work that we did there, and it's a great product. But I also realized in doing that the space of possible ways of fixing up brains, to say it colloquially, or, you know, neuromodulation, to use the fancy word, is a lot broader than just pharmacological interventions. So I was like, okay, I need to take a step back and really get my head screwed on straight about what the possibilities are. So the first thing I did was sort of get to that list you're referring to, which is just like, you know, a brain dump of, and a literature review of like everything I could find, you know, every way from meditation to gamma, you know, ray therapy, of ways to mess around with what's going on in the brain. And in doing that, one area that I've become particularly interested in is ultrasound, which most people associate with like pregnant ladies' bellies and things. But the technology itself, you know, is applicable to any part of the body. And it's also not just for imaging, but it can also be used for various kinds of mechanical changes, whether like at a low intensity doing neuromodulation, you know, we think, or it's already actually used at high intensities for things like tumor ablation. So there's a lot of cool work being done there. But anyway, to answer your question, the reason I'm excited about it is just it has a lot of potential to like give us really fine-grained control over how we modulate the brain that a lot of other modalities don't have.
So there are already like really intense ultrasound devices kind of on the market that are used for tumor ablation, but then you're kind of like, okay, well, maybe if we tune it down, we can actually start to change the brain in kind of more positive ways. Typically I hear about transcranial stimulation versus, I haven't really heard as much about ultrasound. Like I think Halo is using transcranial magnetic. I'm not sure exactly what they're doing, but I haven't heard much about ultrasound. So what is ultrasound and how does that exactly
work? Yeah, well, first I gotta throw in there that I'm not saying that it's strictly useful. I've done like no primary research in this area, but it's an area of active research that other smart people are doing that I have discovered and am happy to help promote. But yeah, anyway, to answer your question. So the fundamentals of ultrasound are the same in terms of whether you're imaging, you know, something in your abdomen or whether you're putting it in your brain, it's a mechanical, you know, oscillations that can be targeted and then, you know, used in order, you can use the reflections of those ultrasound waves off of different types of tissues or, you know, the interfaces of tissues to get some kind of visualization of what's going on inside the body. So yeah, I guess all like imaging and stimulation modalities ultimately come down to like, there are some physical properties that we understand. How can we exploit them to do what we want, you know? So if it's x-rays, you know, for imaging, you're using the fact that, you know, x-rays go through your body pretty well, but they go through some tissues better than others. Okay, we can sort of use that to take a picture. This is kind of like the neurohackers like mentality of you know, how all these things work, right? It's like, okay, we have some physics, we know some physics, how can we use this physics in a clever way? And then when you have ultrasound, you know, you're using the fact that reflection and refraction happen differently in different tissues, and so you can fire in, you know, for ultrasound imaging, you can fire in a bunch of ultrasound pulses. And if you know the timing of when you set them off and you can detect when they're bouncing back, you can use that information to use some linear algebra and you can get a sense of what's going on. You can also do things. So one thing people noticed, this is getting to the more like high intensity ablation stuff. People noticed that like, hey, you know, if you use really high intensity, high frequency ultrasound, you get these interesting nonlinear wave effects where you can like build up, to speak colloquially, you know, like a little focused packet of energy that deposits a bunch of heat in the brain. And so, you know, you can make a big system that goes around your head and fires in a pulse that is targeted really to like, you know, millimeter level precision. And we can like boil tissue in this little just tiny, tiny region. And so that's what people currently use for tumor treatments. I actually just a couple of weeks ago went and observed a treatment at Brigham and Women's here in Boston, where I am. And it's truly amazing. I mean, it's always fun to see practitioners do something that's like utterly amazing and they're really bored and you think it's incredible. So I was watching someone who had getting a treatment for essential tremor, which is, you know, where your hands are really, really shaky. It's an older person. And, you know, they there's a lot of like preamble and shaving heads and lying on tables and blah, but you basically, and then you walk out of the room, you sonicate the patient, it takes like 30 seconds. You go back in the room, you go, hey, hold your hands up. And it's just
That's like, insane.
I mean, it's really unbelievable how quickly it works. And that is actually that's not burning out tumors, to be clear. To be honest, don't know the exact mechanism, but you're burning out some tissue in the thalamus. These are these thalamotomies, and you're getting rid of some population of neurons that's causing that tremor. And
it's typically like, hyperactive neurons that you're getting rid of or ones that aren't.
To be honest, I have no idea what the etiology of essential. All I know is that, yeah, you do this these thalamotomy procedures where you ablate some tissue in the thalamus, in a very specific area of the thalamus. And then it seems to have this positive effect on the tremor symptom.
Okay. So what are some other ultrasound studies that have interested you?
So like the initial burst of excitement, and again, I'm terrible with dates, so I get the dates wrong, but there was a sort of initial burst of excitement when the technique was rediscovered. And then there were these two papers in 2018 that were like, hey, this is all actually just because the mice you're using, you're like stimulating their auditory system with the buzzing and it has nothing to do. And so that kind of like crushed a lot of hopes, I think, for a little while. But then more careful work has been done since then showing that, oh no, there is an effect if you do the right, you know, you do the right shams, they're called. Sham is just a placebo effect for like devices, they call it shams.
Yeah,
but if you do the right shams, there's still an effect.
So I was going to ask, like a lot of people use theta waves to study and they say that it makes them more focused. Does this have any relationship to this? Like, is that a potential mechanism?
Yeah, I would say that, like, I mean, that's the hardest part, it seems, again, as not as someone who's ever done this to anyone in the lab, but by far the hardest part seems to be doing good placebo controls, or again, the term people use in the device world is sham controls. Sham meaning like a fake simulation that in theory, the subject is not supposed to know, you're not doing the thing. So there's lots of issues with all these different techniques. You're referring presumably to some of these like transcranial alternating current devices. And again, I'm terrible with these names.
I know that a lot of people will study to YouTube music that, you know, emits theta waves, but then that the transcranial magnetic devices use theta waves and there's also gamma waves associated with that. I'm not exactly sure the correlation, but I was just wondering like if listening to the theta waves can have some kind of impact similar to the theta waves being emitted into your brain.
I would say, I mean, it's certainly a hypothesis that it's worth testing. I actually don't know specifically on that. So in my like, you know, very much outsider informal categorization of the system, I call techniques like what you're describing peripheral techniques, not peripheral meaning like less good, but just peripheral meaning they come from the peripheral nervous system and they get into the, so like one way, you know, it's all about just hang on, what are you manipulating in the brain? So one way you can manipulate the brain is, you know, you can run a bunch of electric current through it. And that definitely does something, like, you know, electroconvulsive therapy definitely works. And actually as a sidebar, it's maybe the most like maligned thing in medicine, but it's like has this horrible branding from being used in movies like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, but it's actually, it seems like it's super effective and safe the way they do it nowadays, where they put you under anesthesia and you use it. But the point is, if you run a big current through someone's brain, it definitely does something. But you know, you don't have to run the current through yourself. You can also like get current in via your body's nerves. So, you know, if you're like tickling someone, you are stimulating their brain. It's just going through, you know, the nerves and then into the skull. So the idea with these peripheral techniques, including the ones you're describing of like listening to, you know, sounds of different frequencies or like flashing lights, you can, by the like collective action of all these nerves, your whatever optic nerves, like auditory system, whatever, you can potentially entrain or, you know, strengthen different frequency bands in the brain, like, you know, these like theta burst therapy. Well, theta burst therapy, I think, is usually transcranial magnetic, where that's actually you're using big magnets to induce a current. But the thing you're describing is like, hey, can I just listen to, you know, audio that's at some frequency and then, you know, entrain my brain's natural rhythms? Certainly, there's a lot of evidence for that. I don't actually know if the specific like YouTube video style works, but I mean, one really exciting company in this space is Cognito Therapeutics. And they just finished two really exciting phase two trials for Alzheimer's, where they basically use like these 40 hertz flickering lights and like headphones. And it seems like that has a really beneficial effect in slowing down the progression of Alzheimer's. So like phase three results still haven't come in, so we'll see what happens. Mm-hmm. But I would say there's a very strong chance that you're probably familiar with this like debacle. Have you heard about this that happened recently?
No, I haven't.
There's this Alzheimer's drug that got approved that everyone kind of thinks is bogus. That certainly has not, it's not been a resoundingly like, not everyone is super excited about it. But the, you know, there's a solid chance that the people at companies like Cognito Therapeutics might be releasing a treatment for Alzheimer's that beats this now sort of best in class, and they're going to do it. I mean, this drug costs like, I think, tens of thousands of dollars, right? That is how they're selling it. The system that the Cognito folks are making is like, I mean, I hacked one together with an Arduino LED strip. I mean, it's literally just flashing lights, right? You just flashing lights and sounds. You know, you got to like wear the thing for a while, and you have to let it do its work. And the treatment might be kind of like involve sitting for an hour having lights flash at you. But yeah, that would be pretty amazing if a device just comes and like sweeps the floor with the like super expensive drug that just got approved. That could happen. That'd be incredible. That'd be really interesting.
So is the sound delivered through like your ears, or is it also a strip along the top of the headphones?
I think it's just headphones and goggles.
Wow.
Yeah. So again, it's not like you're putting any current through the brain straight up. It's just sounds and lights, but those sounds and lights are hitting neurons, and those neurons go into your brain. And so if you're flashing lights at 40 hertz, that means the optic nerve is firing 40 hertz, and that's going into your brain, and that's getting energy in at 40 hertz.
And do you know the mechanism of how that helps Alzheimer's? And could that be used for like, to improve memory in normal functioning people?
Yeah. I mean, not only do I not know, I'm pretty sure nobody knows. Yeah, I'm sure
there are a lot of people are asking that question, but nobody is answering that question.
Right. And of course, we still have to figure out if it really does work, because there is there's always this question of, are you doing the right sham? So it's one thing if you flash a bunch of lights on one people and not others and they do better, but it's like, well, okay, what if these people get 40 hertz flashes and these people get 30 hertz flashes? Is the magic really in the 40 hertz? Are we really in training something? Is it just that like turns out that if you subject people to a bunch of flashy lights and like make them sit down for an hour, that's actually really good for them?
Yeah. So what about like improving like strength training? Like, is there something that you can do with ultrasound that will either strength training or maybe like memory? Like, is there something that helps normal people, or is it mostly more diseased people?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would. It's so early to even like. If right now, it doesn't do anything for anybody. It has a lot of promise. So I guess the excitement for me is not there. There's such a huge landscape of possible use cases. The thing that gets me excited is coming up with tools that have a lot of versatility that might let us be able to explore this stuff. So okay. the fundamentals of ultrasound is there. It seems to be, again, there's engineering required and science required, but the fundamental physics will allow us to have really spatially precise and even, you know, flexible, like on the fly, movable stimulation in the brain. What are we going to be able to do with that level of control? Maybe nothing. I mean, that would be sad. Like, it's possible it just doesn't do anything, but more likely it's just this big, this really incredible new tool and what to do with it. So yeah, I mean, it really could go any number of ways, but it's hard to say right now.
You're most focused on developing the tools to actually start doing these. So what's like the most needed tool? Is it more precision? Or it sounds like with the ultrasound, we have precision to ablate those tumors. Or is it like controlling frequency, or what's the most needed tool?
Yeah, I'm starting to sound like a broken record here. I mean, we don't know is the answer. I guess maybe here's how I might think about it. So, well, first of all, let me say why I think the flexibility, the tool building matters so much. I think you can get the impression from outside of a scientific field that, you know, it's all about, hey, if we just understand these mechanisms a little better, you know, then of course we'll be able to design like a perfect treatment to do something. And so it's this kind of march of, you know, make a small discovery, like figure out how some system works, and then we'll perfectly know how to manipulate it, and et cetera. And not my read of neuroscience, and having worked in two previous scientific fields of chemistry and machine learning, that's certainly not how those fields progress. It tends to be, there's a lot more serendipity required to make progress. And also, you know, it's possible to discover a tool or a treatment or something first, and then have the understanding of how it works come way, way later. So they're both important, but I would say that I think the current scales are tipped a little more in favor of the kind of characterization type of work and less in favor of the tool building work. And if you're going to try and increase the amount of serendipity and the amount of discoveries that are possible, you need more shots on goal. You need more people having hypotheses and trying stuff. And, you know, there's no culture of like garage tinkerers in neuroscience or in neurotech. That there certainly is in terms of like pharmaceutical stuff, which we can come to. But, you know, these tools are just hard to use. They're expensive and they're not like user-friendly. And so the more we can push these things into realms where, and I'm not suggesting like literally people do this in their garage at all, but right now it's like a very few labs who have ultrasound, you know, engineers and expertise. And instead this could become something like fMRI, where it's a tool any, you know, psychologist or neurologist can use without too much trouble. And that's, you know, like any tool, you know, you just need more people to use it, more people to try things. And then that's how you discover the good stuff.
So then it sounds like we need to build a cheaper, smaller, maybe portable like ultrasound devices? Are most of the ultrasound neuromodulation devices like very large, expensive, bulky, or what do they kind of look like, and how can you improve that?
Yeah, it's more, I think, and this is something that comes up a lot, I think, when I talk to people who are interested in the space. The money is an issue, but it's way less of an issue than just the complexity. So, you know, in academia, people get grants, like it's not that they're impoverished and then they can't buy the tools they need. It's usually the issue of, well, if I'm going to use this tool, that's like I'm devoting a post, or, you know, a whole grad student and half of a postdoc's time to like figuring out how this tool works and, you know, how are we going to do research with it? And oh my God, we have to get it installed in the lab and do a whole lab setup. And then it's probably going to break and we're going to have a service contract. And so right now the systems aren't big or bulky or crazy or expensive. It's just, you have to have the know-how of, okay, well, we got to go buy an ultrasound transducer from, you know, these people and hook it up to an arbitrary waveform generator that we get from these other people, and I have to know how to program that. And so it's really the complexity cost, not the monetary cost, that tends to be the barrier, not just in ultrasound, but in many areas. And so the ease of use conjures to mind kind of like UX and stuff, which I think is important, but it really comes down more to just technology that allows you to more confidently make the kind of manipulations in the brain that you want to make. And some of that actually comes down just the fundamentals of the technology. Like right now, if you want to target an ultrasound beam, the way you do it is you go get a CT scan of a skull and you use that to do some simulations. And then that tells you where to put the transducer. And there's a lot of big question marks in there. Like, you know, do we actually know where the ultrasound signal is going? Not that well. And so like imaging technologies could be leveraged to improve that. Like that we actually, the stuff is the place, you know, we're putting the signal is where we think it is in the brain. Like that's not obvious. So that's the kind of thing I mean by like tool building.
So it sounds like you need another machine to map the brain, and then you place the ultrasound transducers on there. Is there any way to like use the reflections of the ultrasound beams to kind of map the brain at least enough to start knowing where you need to be? So then instead of requiring two machines, you just need the ultrasound and then it like maps and then it targets?
Yeah. No, it's a great question. I mean, and it's something lots of people are thinking about. It's something I'm really interested in actually as like a potential use case for machine learning or at least optimization. The one tricky thing is if you want to, you know, image what some kind of, how do I say this? If you want to look where ultrasound is going and you use ultrasound to do it, you run the risk that like whatever is messing up the stimulation signal is also going to mess up your imaging. So to be like more concrete, if someone's skull has a funny shape or density or something, and the ultrasound beam, and this is like, this totally happens, right? And the ultrasound beam is diverted in the brain from where you think that it's going. Issue with getting ultrasound to the brain is that the skull is like a gigantic attenuation and lensing piece of matter in the way. And so it tends to, you know, unlike what you can do in like your abdomen or something, it tends to really mess up the signal that you get. And so you have to work around that. And, you know, whatever nasty thing the skull is doing to that stimulation beam, it's also probably going to do to an ultrasound imaging setup. So you just have to be like mindful of that. It's kind of best if you can image with a totally like orthogonal technology or some physics technology. Even. If you can image with totally different physics to the way you're stimulating. So like, just because then you run less risk of having the artifact that's affecting one affect the other at the same time. And you'd like never notice it. I'm trying to think of like a good metaphor for this, but I can't. But like, yeah, MRI is like great for, yeah, looking where the ultrasound is going, because it, you know, it doesn't, it has totally different interaction with the skull and tissues inside. Okay.
So like for example, if we target, this is like a training question. Like if we target everybody's hypothalamus, let's just like take a structure of the brain. And then we do that, let's say like on 1,000 patients, and we start to learn what the reflections off of the hypothalamus look like. Like, can you then put that on the 1,001 patient and then find the hypothalamus? Like, is it just a training problem where you need a bunch of training data of what the hypothalamus reflections look like? Would that be useful? Or is it like going to just be a problem every time because everybody has unique skull shape and the reflections are just difficult to, like too hard to find?
Yeah, there's certainly, when you're trying to target specific regions of the brain, to get to the point that you made, like if you want to target the hypothalamus, my understanding of almost every structure in the brain is that the acoustic properties of them are all too, you'll never be able to distinguish them with a pure ultrasound signal going from outside the skull. Maybe not never, you know, like it's really hard if all of the attenuation of the skull to image that. The difference is too fine grained. And some things like some named structures in the brain, there is the only difference in our nomenclature is we've just decided like, hey, this is the, you know, I'm trying to think of an example, but like, you know, hey, this is the temporal lobe and this is the frontal lobe. You know, it's on your head. It's not yeah. like there's no dividing line that says like this is one thing. So okay. in terms of that, I don't think you could, you can't probably do a training setup like that. But what I would say is certainly there are structures in the brain, like potentially, you know, blood vessels or things like that, that you could potentially use to try and learn how to correct the signal. Maybe that's, you know, mm-hmm. hypothetical. And then there's, I think the larger point you were making is, you know, is there a way we can use some other signal to figure out if we're hitting what we want? And that we, you know, potentially, yeah, can do. So for example, if you know that hitting, I don't know, whatever like little region, locus coeruleus, you know, causes some really obvious change in, I don't know what, the person's heart rate or perfusion or some felt sensation, I don't even know, whatever it is. Well, then you can use that as a feedback signal. And so then, yeah, maybe you could try to, like, you're pretty sure you're in the neighborhood and then like try to move it around. Again, that's
you like connect to their some safety questions and start messing them up. And then you're like, okay, we're in the right spot.
That is also something you can do too. Yeah. If you just, the other thing is, you know, as you were suggesting, you could also just not care. Like, actually, this is something you asked before, and I forgot to answer in my ramblings, but like we actually don't know how important spatial localization is, neuromodulation of various behaviors. It might not actually matter that much. We don't know. Definitely, if you want to burn out a tumor and the tumor is in one place, then yeah, it really matters that you can localize. So that's obviously really valuable. And I would say as a tool for researchers, it's incredibly valuable because you can test all of these functional localization hypotheses that in the, you know, normally we, you know, like do lesion studies or something like that. We like, as if I do these, I don't do this, but, you know, neuroscientists do lesion studies where they'll, you know, usually not in a human, you know, in an animal, you'll injure some part of the brain and then see what is affected. And, you know, there's all these famous case studies like Phineas Gage, people who had injuries to their brain. And that's partly how we learned what certain regions of the brain are associated with. But you could, in principle, do that with just ultrasound, you know, non-invasively, non-harmfully, just like, hey, and temporarily use ultrasound beam and like turn down all of the firings in this area of your brain and see what happens. So
very broad.
So it's that the localization is valuable for that. Exactly. On top of all that, like, is any of that actually matter for curing somebody's chronic pain? Who knows? We got to figure that out. But it might, it's totally possible that it will not be as useful of a feature as, for example, what a drug can do, which is specifically target, you know, a particular receptor or something. That's not spatially localized in terms of, you know, large scale. It's not like in this half, that half, but it is really fine grained.
Yeah. Cause you might be targeting like acetylcholine in one section of the brain, but then it gets uptaken in like multiple parts of the brain.
Yeah. You could do that too. Yeah. And that's another thing that ultrasound lets you do, which is pretty exciting and is farther along than the just kind of straight up neuromodulation. Is you can also use ultrasound in combination with an injection of microbubbles to open up the blood-brain barrier, but selectively. So you can let drugs that normally wouldn't get into the brain into the brain in a very specific region by using an ultrasound, a focused ultrasound beam. And
so you wouldn't go into other areas of the brain. So you can essentially
it normally wouldn't go anywhere in the brain. Yeah, kind of. It's like you give someone a drug that normally just doesn't make it through the blood-brain barrier. For people who don't know, there's this set of cells that surround all of the vasculature in the brain, and it prevents a lot of things from getting into the brain that normally would perfuse into other tissues in the body. But you can use this blood-brain barrier disruption techniques to temporarily, you basically, as far as we know, or as far as I've read, you like are using these microbubbles and the ultrasound hits the bubbles and they kind of expand and contract and they don't explode, but they just like gently go bigger and smaller and they push open the walls of the blood vessels in the brain, and that lets drugs kind of slide on through and sneak into the brain. And so you can do that in a very specific area. And so the whole system is perfused with, all your whole bloodstream is perfused with some drug, but it only gets to neurons in like that one area where your
microbubbles. Okay.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You just sort of squeeze apart the cells that are lining the blood vessel, and it's the bubbles that are like pushing up against it and doing that, we think.
That's fascinating. So then you would be a pharmaceutical company and an ultrasound company.
There's certainly a bunch that are interested of, you know, pharmaceutical companies who are looking in this, but they look at a lot of stuff. So make of that what you will.
I guess going back to the tools, I was also thinking like, So if you can't image the brain using pure ultrasound, would it be possible to make a device that has like one layer where it can image, uses some technology that can image, and then it has a second layer that then activates the ultrasound once it's imaged? I'm just trying to like go back to the tools helping researchers like utilize these experiments faster. So yeah, if you could have a multi-layered device, do you think that's reasonable or possible? Or
yeah, whether it's possible, I'm definitely the worst person to ask because I'm like not an electrical engineer. People are certainly working on stuff like that though. And yeah, I mean, that's the dream though, in terms of accessibility of tools, is that it's just like a VR headset. You know, it's something you just throw on your head and it lets the researcher, you know, it just shows them an image of what's inside your head. And it's like, cool, we're going to stimulate exactly here and for this long and with this frequency. Hey, take this, you know, cognitive test while you do it and we'll learn something. I think, I don't know what the early days of fMRI looked like, but I'm sure they involved a heck of a lot of engineering and it was probably like really hard to do. And now it's, you know, there are systems that are pretty turnkey and lots of researchers can use them. But I, you know, there's not like I have a clear path from here to this awesome headset.
Yeah. So what other tools do you think are needed? Are there maybe like software tools that can just plug into these devices and then like multiple types of devices and then look if the training is actually improving the person, or what other kind of tools are needed?
Yeah, I mean, I guess
it sounds like you're focused on tools mostly other than like specific improvements.
Right. Yes. I mean, yeah, it's like kind of every part of the stack needs some help for sure. There's all the way from, you know, I guess one cut you can take on this is to think of it just from sort of the like the low level hardware side all the way up through the like functional sort of whatever, you know, psychological testing side and everything in between. You know, there's room for improvement. So, you know, if you're a hardware person, there's advances in, you know, MEMS technology and things like that are going to be really helpful for getting MEMS, micro electromechanical systems, I believe is the acronym, but yeah, just, you know, really small scale systems that can do ultrasound imaging and simulation. You know, that, you know, pushing that direction is really important. You've got just the straight up engineering problem of like, how do we, you know, build reliable systems that are easily, you know, usable by clinicians. And that's part software, it's part electrical engineering, it's part hardware, it's part, you know, design thinking. And then, yeah, the highest level of, you know, just are we even evaluating patients in the right way? Are we giving them tests and batteries and things that are useful? That's, you know, I presumably psychologists spend a lot of their time trying to figure out, and all of it needs work. Yeah. But I haven't discovered any like real like linchpin, you know, leverage points where it's like, oh gosh, if just we fix this one thing, it would all go flying forward. There's a lot of little bits and a lot of systems engineering that needs to go into this stuff.
So you're working on finding the linchpin in your words.
Yeah. And I'd be pretty happy and hopefully I could try and push on it or remove it, whatever the metaphor is for the linchpin. But yeah, there's plenty of barriers, but it's not obvious to me, even, you know, having looked at this for a couple months, like exactly what the sweet spot is, or then it's probably not one, almost never.
So like if somebody was listening to this and they maybe want to start a startup and maybe they want to reach out to you, like what kind of, if you're planning to eventually start a startup, let's just say like hypothetically, like what co-founder qualities would you need? Like what would you want in a person?
That's a good question. I guess I should caveat with I'm pretty method agnostic right now. So I'm just trying to make sure I understand the space, and a startup is a good way of getting stuff done for sure. But it, you know, relies on a lot of assumptions about future profitability and things like that, and that may not be appropriate for the state of the technology. So I'm just trying to understand the space. And then, you know, if the right thing to do is to, you know, start a startup, then we'll start a startup. If the right thing is to, you know, get a grant and do some kind of, you know, science, you know, more open science academic project to push stick, I'll do that. And there's probably multiple things that are doable. But yeah, so taking your hypothetical. So if it turns out there's like a startup for the opportunity, and so you're kind of asking like what skill sets are needed here. I mean, as I said, I think really the whole span of like hard tech disciplines. I mean, you know, you need software engineers, you need hardware engineers, you need electrical engineers. Medical device expertise is something that I think is relatively rare in like the discourse around hard tech. I think people kind of don't often think of that as its own skill set, but it definitely is. Like there's a lot of know-how that's specific to working on medical devices. And so people who have like, you know, engineers, medical device engineers are a rarer commodity than I wish they were, and are certainly really important. And yeah, I think also, you know, a little bit going along with that, but kind of UX product design thinking-y people, people who can go into look at the existing workflows of researchers and design tools for their needs. That may be a kind of, you know, universal skill set that people have who are good product people. I don't know what that magic skill set is, where you know don't ask people what they want. You sort of ask the right questions and figure out what they want. Maybe that's not even a coherent skill set, and it's just some knack people have. I don't know, but there's certainly, probably because there's not as much money in it, but there's a lot fewer people out there trying to make better research tooling with the level of care and thought that goes into your average, you know, SaaS product. So, you know, if you work at a tech company, you got people on in your inbox all the time being like, hey, can we talk about your process? And like, how are you doing this? And I don't think a single time as a grad student, anyone was like, hey, can I talk about like, if you like your machine learning framework? And that was in machine learning, which is an area where actually there's a ton of investment, and probably some people must have been getting those calls, but I'm pretty sure it doesn't happen that often for, you know, the poor people out there who are like trying to build the ultrasound systems of the future.
Yeah.
That would be great to have more of that.
So speaking of like the medical device experience, one of the hardest parts, I think, of like starting a startup in this space is that you have to go through FDA clearance or medical device clearance. Are there any applications where you can kind of like bootstrap a revenue stream without having to do that? And then eventually you can take that money and go and get medical device clearance? Like, are there any other applications of this technology that you're interested in? Like, for example, like if you're doing gene editing, like you might want to focus on plants and then go into humans. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, so the usual, there's a lot there, I guess. This is kind of a generic biotech answer. The usual workarounds are either like agricultural or veterinary. If you don't want to start straight in humans, like if your technology can use some more development and you don't want to go the traditional FDA route. Maybe I should explain that for people who don't know that to get approved, well, what the FDA lets you do is market product, either whatever drug or biologic product or medical device. It lets you market that for a specific disease indication. So you're allowed to say things like, this will help you cure your Alzheimer's, versus if you say that and you haven't gotten approved by them, then they can take action against you. So the reason that matters is not just because it's a nice badge, but that importantly, it allows people to get insurance reimbursement for using your product for that disease. So to treat that disease. So the standard path, I'll just stick to medical devices right now, but like the standard path for medical devices is, you know, you identify some disease you want to treat, you build a medical or whatever process you want to improve, you build a medical device to do that thing, you send it through the regulatory pathway, which is like kind of long, complicated, but people can Google, and then you get approval, and then the product is allowed to be used for that particular indication. And then you, the company, make money. You know, the overall, you're making money because the insurance is paying patients' bills who use this product that you've made. And that's a standard pathway. And it's like long and slow and challenging. And there's so many failure points along the way. It's like a very high risk endeavor and requires a lot of money to do all the clinical trials, which are very expensive in order to get approval. So yeah, I guess what you're asking. So like, that's the sort of standard path. And you can certainly, you know, you can certainly start a company on the hope that you'll be able to discover an application of, you know, take ultrasound or any other tools and just start that company. And maybe you can raise some money and go for it. The odds of success though are, you know, not high, which is not a reason not to do it. But it was suggesting, you know, one other way, maybe generate more data or get a better understanding, is to take an alternate route. And there are a number of these. The big one for medical devices is the sort of general wellness device. So I am, again, totally bad with the names here, but I think the company is Think with Y. And then there's, I think Halo also is falls in this category.
Yeah, I was going to say Halo, and then there's Nearable.
I think that's right. Yeah, so I think they all fall under, I can't remember if those are, some of those are just like readout technologies or just doing EEG, or which ones are doing stimulation. But anyway, these like transcranial direct current devices or transcranial alternating current devices, right now they're considered general wellness devices. Well, I should say they are, the companies who make them are specifically not making medical claims. They're not saying this will cure your Alzheimer's. And therefore they are under this like general wellness category, which the FDA, you know, doesn't regulate. Although there are a lot of noises that they're going to be kind of a maybe crackdown sort of soonish. I think COVID may have delayed that, but they released this guidance about general wellness devices a couple of years ago and then haven't heard much from them since. But like there's probably going to be something coming down from the FDA on devices that are like putting currents through your, you know.
Yeah. And is that because it like hasn't been proven enough to be not detrimental, or why are they cracking down on that?
Right. I mean, it's, well, yeah, that's probably a bigger question of why in the like society and macro econ. But I mean, the specific reason is, I mean, I guess it's just, I guess, are you asking why they would crack down on it in lieu of someone?
Like, does it sound kind of, is there any danger to these? I mean, I'm not like trying to spread right. fear or anything, but it's right. like you're stimulating your brain and that kind of is worrisome. So like, is there any harm yeah. that could be done or?
I mean, I guess yeah, it's just a general concern with any you know, drug or food, okay. which is like regulated, which is that you're basically allowed to innovate in any kind of new area and people are allowed to do whatever they want to themselves. It tends to be, that's a distinction I think a lot of people don't know. It's like, I mean, you're basically allowed, unless you're talking about drugs, which are scheduled by the DEA, which is like a separate agency that has its own separate enforcement that it's doing. But mm-hmm. I mean, you're allowed to do pretty much whatever you want to yourself. Yeah. Like if you decide you want to like install whatever neodymium magnets in your fingertips, like some of the like transhumanists, at least at one point I read an article about them doing that. That's fine. I mean, the FDA is not going to stop you from doing that on yourself. But if you want to go and start selling and like performing surgeries to do that, that's presumably where you run into trouble. I don't know the specifics of the legality of magnet. So yeah, then it just becomes this question of, I mean, I'm assuming it just has to do with the popularity of the intervention. If a bunch of teenagers accidentally like burn their scalps trying to study harder with TDCS, then that gets attention and then like people want to do something about it, but there's no, it's not like they'll ever be able to ban you from going and buying a 9-volt battery and hooking it up to 2 sponges and like putting it on your head. Well, that's not true. I guess they could do that, but that is not in the foreseeable future unless it gets you high, which we don't think that it does.
So do you know if like Halo or Nearable, if these companies are planning to expand from like general wellness into therapies, like using their device, like can they just have a software update and then it can start doing other techniques? Or maybe they already have a manufacturing line and they just added a small change to it or something. Like, do you think that's their roadmap or is there more money in general wellness? And now I'm kind of like getting into broad startup ecosystem.
No, it's a good question. This is similar to the kind of 23andMe or what I understand to be the 23andMe model, which is start as a consumer company providing a consumer service and then use the data from that to get approval to do something. I'm not actually sure which way it's doing, but that's my understanding of their pathway. That's in the more diagnostic space, presumably for 23andMe. But yeah, it's a similar idea that some of these companies I imagine are taking, where you start as a general wellness device, you use the money from that to run more clinical trials and get more data. And obviously, you know, all the other things, build your company and your manufacturing capability, et cetera. And then maybe you can go after a specific indication once you've used the data you've gathered to figure out what the play would be. Although, man, that would not be my first choice. Those are hard trials to run compared to like, yeah. you know, I don't know, ADHD or something. I mean, it's all hard really, but the amount of time that it takes to run like an Alzheimer's trial is.
Yeah. And maybe with ADHD, like you can, like, I think Nearable has it as part of their app, like how well you focus during that time. So then instead yeah. of just like injecting brainwaves, they're also sensing what's going on in your brain. So then they have like a two-way data stream. So that way they can actually prove like, oh, it is helping people that are diagnosed with ADHD, like actually focus for longer periods of time. Like as they've used this device, like they've kind of gone up.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's, yeah, I wasn't suggesting that like ADHD is harder or less hard than Alzheimer's or anything, but in terms of the trial length, you know, to do most Alzheimer's trials, you're looking at the rate of decline. And so you have to kind of track that over, you know, many, many months. And I mean, I've seen ones as short as like a couple months, but I think that, you know, the signal is weaker or the effect size is weaker. Whereas presumably you can, there's a company, I think it's Akili Interactive. I'm not sure if they're going after ADHD, but the point is they're going after more acute use or like things that you can evaluate in a shorter clinical trial point. So okay. those kind of indications tend to be easier, right? I mean, the extreme case would be, I'm actually not sure if this is a real indication, but if something like, you know, acute suicidality or like antipsychosis, right? That's something that it's a hard trial to run for a separate reason, because recruiting patients is like maybe, I don't know how you would recruit patients for an antipsychosis trial. I mean, people probably have done it, but you can at least, you know, give someone some drug or something and go like, okay, gosh, well, like they calmed down and it took 2 minutes. So that's a pretty clear signal and it's fairly easy to evaluate. Whereas if you want to evaluate a claim like this headset helped me feel better for, you know, over the course of a year, like that's just really hard. Yeah, it's just hard to evaluate.
Yeah. So we need better tracking of that. Similar to how like with aging, instead of like doing the longevity trials, we need to have a Horvath clocks or better clocks to actually measure how the age changes after.
Yeah, that's a pretty good analogy. I would say also though that a similar idea in aging is the idea that just stop worrying about anything that's not a rejuvenation technology, right? So that's very much that's what I understand to be George Church's thesis on this, which is like, forget, you know, trying to slow down decline, like let's just do technologies that rejuvenate. Because I can tell you pretty quickly, if I, you know, give you some gene therapy and your whatever, your liver, and your liver starts looking like it's a 30 years younger liver, then that's who, you know, like the most slowing down you can do is reversing. Just yeah. Do that, right? You don't have to wait 20 years to see if you extended someone's life. And so there's a similar, I wouldn't call it like a thesis. Certainly if there is some kind of neuromodulation modality that has an acute effect, that is way easier to measure. So psychedelic therapy is, you know, they had like MAPS has had to do quite a lot of work developing the clinical trials for this, because like, how do you do a placebo for a psychedelic? I mean, everyone knows that they got it, right? Like,
yeah.
you know, assuming you're using a real dose. So yeah, but the point is it also helps with developing the therapeutic, right? If you can test whether or not something is efficacious in a short time span, then that's a lot easier. But obviously there are lots of things that act more slowly. So it's not a fundamental barrier. Like SSRIs take a long time to start working. Transcranial magnetic stimulation for depression, FDA approved treatment, takes a long time to start working, and it's subtle, but you know, it seems to work for at least many people.
So I don't really have a specific question to jump off of that, but like, just maybe like talking about the broad future of these, like in, I don't know, let's just say 20, it's really hard to predict these timeframes, but do you see a future where like we wake up and we put on our hat or something and it has these devices in them and it like stimulates the effect of caffeine in our brain or something, and then we go work out and it increases like our muscle memory, and then we start reading and it increases our learning retention? Like what do you kind of see as the broad future of these devices? Like what gets you most excited about this field?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big question. I certainly the most exciting, I think there is so many angles on this. Many people, I think, who are like high functioning members of society, I think because they are pretty high functioning, tend to discount how bad just the general amount of suffering is in the world. And it's easy, I think, if you're a high functioning person surrounded by high functioning people at your cool, you know, tech job or whatever, again, not to like try and stereotype, but yeah. There's certainly people who suffer from like mental health in every field. But I think it can be easier to write off because it's not something that affects you. And this is kind of this horrible paradox of at least some kinds of mental illness, is that precisely the kind of people who the disease turns you into a person who is the kind of person who can't do anything about your disease, right? So like depression, for example, you know, there's lots of ways to treat depression, but the fundamental thing depression does is make you not want to do anything. So it's this like horrible, you know, paradox and trap. And I think that's true. Yeah. And feedback loop, exactly. And so I think there's a lot of types of suffering that are more silent in the like tech discourse, I guess I would say, than I think they ought to be. And I think that we should be paying more attention to, not that no one's paying attention to it, there's lots of investment, but you know, I wish the amount of excitement around, you know, potential treatments for depression or chronic pain or things like that was as loud as around their topics. I think it deserves to be something that the tech world focuses on more. So yeah, that's kind of the downer side, but that is the thing I'm more excited about, is like alleviating the suffering. But I think there's also obviously exciting, you know, the betterment of well people side of things and the enhancement side of things. That's also really important too. You know, ultimately we just want to let people, I think that we want to let people have as much ability to fix whatever they think is ailing them as possible. And I smuggled in there is a little bit of my personal feelings about, I do worry about the level of pathologization or you know, medicalization of some of these things that we now call like, you know, mental illnesses. I do think people should ultimately have the choice over whether they decide that the way their brain works is a problem for them or not. And, you know, we should have helpful, you know, norms around that and be able to give people good advice. But, you know, if you decide that your ADHD is not a disease, it's just how your brain works, I think that's great. So it's not that I'm saying like, oh, we found all these people over here and they have depression and they're in the depression bucket. We want to go sprinkle depression cures on them and get them back to normal. I just think that it's having the ability to modulate how your brain works is, you know, many of the most important technological developments humanity's ever made are in that category.
Bringing people like back to baseline is more important to you than like increasing baseline. Like that's what you're more focused on, because you think.
Yeah, I would say emotionally, what I care about is like, helping people alleviate their suffering. But intellectually, I think the goal is just to let people have the tools to change how their brains work to a way that suits them better.
And so like kind of riffing on that first question, in the broad future, like X time frame, what do you think the Apple like device will be, like the iPhone? Like, would this be like a cap or something that we wear every day? Do you think it'll still like what do you think that will look like?
Yeah, these things get really hard to forecast a long way out. And in particular, it gets tricky because oftentimes the things that seem like they'll be the easier things first tend to end up being the harder thing. So like with AI, right? You know, we thought that like, you know, visual perception would be easier than chess. And we actually had pretty good chess solvers like before we had a good deep learning system for vision. So it's never a priori what the easy and hard things are going to be. So it's not like I would say, oh, well, the near term thing is we'll have like this coffee replacement, like you were saying. Because maybe it turns out that just like what, you know, the way stimulants work is like incredibly complicated and there's some fundamental reason why it's hard to do it. And, you know, will get uploaded into the cloud consciousness on the same day that we ever figure out like the next best caffeine. Like it could just be a hard problem. So you never really know. But I think the long-term future, you know, it's hard to imagine a world in which the long-term future isn't implanted technologies, right? Like systems that are somehow inside your skull manipulating your brain. Again, and leaving aside if we all decide to just get uploaded out of our brains into some other form, I guess that really takes a lot of the problems off the table. Mm-hmm. You don't have to worry about the skull messing with your signal if you live on a hard disk. Not that I'm like discounting that or anything like that. I mean, I think that's the kind of thing in the not too long of a future, maybe longer than some people think, but you know, humanity is going to confront that probably eventually. I certainly believe in the kind of AI timelines reports that say that this stuff is in the offing. And maybe it's not humans getting uploaded. It's just that we have, you know, artificial intelligences that do that. Again, it's not like tomorrow, but like not in many centuries.
Like 2050.
Anyway, I mean, really, I never even know what date to put on it, but my predictions are always wrong if they're more than 5 years away. But I guess, so just to answer your question though, I think in a world where we're not dealing with like uploads and things like that, invasive technologies, ones that live inside your head the form factor is way better than anything it's non-invasive. You're not going to have to want to wear a hat or whatever. But in order to develop those technologies, and this is something I think a lot of people in the field maybe neglect more than they should, although again, I'm an outsider, but in order to discover what invasive technology to build requires a lot of experimentation. And experimentation with our current society and laws, and also just what people are willing to do, is much easier with non-invasive methods. So I think that you don't want to skip steps, and that these non-invasive technologies like focused ultrasound, not every non-invasive technology, there's some that I don't think really do much, but technologies like ultrasound and things like that are going to be really important in order to figure out enough about how the brain works to decide what kind of invasive technologies to make. If we only let ourselves experiment with invasive technologies, the pace of experimentation will be much slower. So that's my general thought on that. But so I don't think, you know, the long-term future is us wearing hats probably, but to get to the long-term future, you have to go through a lot of science.
One last question. Did you have any, is neural dust, is that, or the neural grains, whatever it's called, is that invasive? Did you have any hot takes on that? Or that's just been in the news a lot lately.
I missed that news, but I mean, so the neural dust that I'm familiar with is actually ultrasound, or uses ultrasound as part of it. You're sort of putting in these like small, I don't actually know the details of this all, but my understanding is you're putting some small particles in that are acoustically sensitive, and then you're using ultrasound, either like kind of minimally invasive or just planted in the dura or something, or possibly even non-invasive, I'm not sure, but you're using that to communicate with the dust that's spread around. So actually their ultrasound is involved there. I don't know what the current like excitement wave has been on it, but it's certainly, I would consider that invasive. To me, invasive is anything where matter is entering the body. And that includes chemicals, by the way. So I would consider that an invasive treatment.
Like an invasive treatment?
I would, yeah. But again, it's, you know, there's not a hard line here. There's kind of a spectrum. So, and what it really comes down to, again, I'm a little more focused on the near term concerns here. What it comes down to is just what it's easy for people to get IRB and FDA approval to do. Sorry, what kind of research that it's easy for people to get IRB and FDA approval to do. And, you know, these bodies are very safety conscious and very conservative. So microbubbles are, yes, technically invasive. You do have to get an IV of, you know, injection or whatever of these microbubbles, and they're putting some sort of surfactants inside of you. But we can at least like safety test those. And then that's kind of a reliable tool that eventually we can have people trust. And then that lets us do a lot of flexible experimentation in the brain with a fairly conservative, safe, we think, invasive measure. On the other hand, it's like, if you're just trying new drugs every day, you're just like going, you know, you're just ordering whatever random thing from Sigma Aldrich and just taking it. Well, there's tons of risk there, right? I mean, there's, you know, you don't know what you're doing this. Well, assuming you don't read the safety sheet, you don't really know what you're doing. So the neural dust is, yeah, I mean, it's certainly less invasive than like removing your entire skull and putting a giant, you know, blinking device there. But it's yeah, stuff is going in your body. We don't know how it will last after a long time. These are all the risks people, you know, Neuralink has to deal with, or Paradromics or all the other companies, right? We just don't, there's a lot of safety work that goes into some kind of exogenous material in your brain. For and sure. Drugs, at least, I mean, drugs get cleared usually out of your brain. So they don't have that, like those long-term effects you have to watch for, but still, you don't know how they're going to interact with you. So it just slows down. Not that they're bad or that you shouldn't be working on it, but progress is going to be slower usually with those modalities.
Okay. So, I mean, we talked about your background. We talked about the tools that you want to develop. We talked about some startups. We talked about the broad future. Was there like anything else that you kind of wanted to discuss? Any questions that I didn't ask?
No, I mean, we've covered most of my current interests. I'll be interested to hear if anyone finds any of it interesting, but no, I mean, I guess, yeah, it is incumbent on me to better articulate a case for why I think this area of like tool building for neuromodulation is underrated, and I should do that in prose. And I haven't been able to quite do that yet, but I am trying to slowly kind of build the case up for why I think this really matters. And I guess the last thing I'd say is a lot of things people focus on in tech are ultimately trying to deal with suffering by fixing some kind of extrinsic cause of suffering. And that is obviously fantastic and good, and we should do more of it. I would say though, that it's also worth looking at, you know, treating suffering at the source. And, you know, it's really hard to like avoid cliche land when talking about this. So that's why I kind of need to figure out a better way to say it. But, you know, whatever, there's this line from Hamlet, you know, there's nothing either good nor bad, but thinking makes it so. It is true. Like it is actually, we sort of know that, you know, people in tech are so into stoicism and meditation and things like that. And so there's certainly some appreciation of this, but I think that, again, it hasn't received no attention, but compared to the attention that we get for solving extrinsic sources of harm, I wish there was a similar amount of attention to just changing how we are able to deal with suffering, because you're probably never going to deal with every extrinsic cause of suffering. And there's also this hedonic treadmill problem, right? That we just get used to the improvements we make. But the really fundamental breakthroughs may come when we actually figure out how to give people the tools to change how they feel.
Yeah. I think one of the problems is it's just easier to talk about extrinsic sources of suffering. Like it's hard to go on Twitter and be like, I'm not happy, but it's easy be like, I just got hit by a car, and then you'll get like, you know, thousands of likes.
Right. And also it's dangerous. I mean, it is dangerous. Like there's no question that like, you know, you've got risks of the things like wireheading. And I mean, so just to be clear, like humans, it's not that we don't have any neuromodulation technology. We have a lot, and many of the most effective ones are drugs. And all the problems that the like larger scale problems you see about drugs are potential risks with any neuromodulation technologies, right? You can abuse drugs and make yourself feel very, you know, sort of happy, but then end up, you know, dead of an overdose, or let it like ruin your life. And so I think there's a lot of, we need to be really careful about how we do it. I am kind of certainly the bent of like, we should let people make those decisions and mistakes for themselves and then offer them support rather than trying to kind of bottleneck it for pre-market rather than post-market. But there's, you know, certainly there are reasonable constraints to be put at every step of the way. And I just think that, yeah, that as you said, it's easier to call it the extrinsic stuff, and it's also what we're wired to do. And unless you're the kind of person who's introspected a lot or, you know, done whatever psychedelic or meditation retreat, I think that focus on, you know, how your brain is reacting to the world is often less front and center than like, oh gosh, like my, you know, it's so annoying to walk to the store. Like if only I could create another type of new scooter. Again, not to like rip on the scooter people, that there's more scooters or whatever, but you know, there's a lot of work to be done inside the skull as well as outside of it.
Yeah. And mentioning psychedelics actually made me curious, like, have there been any studies of using neuromodulation while on psychedelics?
None that I think of off the top of my head that have been published. I can guarantee you people have tried it, but I can't say who. But yeah, no, not that I know of.
Because I know Ty is using psychedelics and then monitoring the brain, and then I think like talking them through therapy and stuff. It'd be interesting to see if you could start using neuromodulation techniques. Although, you know, the brain is at a different state at that point. So then almost all of our research of a normal functioning brain goes out the window.
Right.
I would assume. That's definitely a very interesting question, because maybe our brain is like neuromodulation fundamentally focuses on neuroplasticity so that we can change things. And I think in a psychedelic state, our brain is more plastic is kind of what I understand. So it's definitely
it'd be really interesting. Yeah. And I think some of the blood-brain barrier opening stuff too is interesting in, you know, what if you could apply a psychedelic just to one part of the brain? Like what would the difference be in effect? You know, like, I mean, maybe it does nothing. Who knows? It could be something really
interesting. That's excellent.
So that's the kind of question you can ask with those technologies in hand. But yeah.
That's really cool. Yeah. Well, we need to make a video for this what I want to do is I want to tweet this, and I want to have like some like blurb about neural modulation, and then new podcasts, and then YouTube link, and then like in that tweet, like, so we'll I can listen to this again and come up with a video idea, or we can riff on video ideas. But yeah, that's the next steps moving forward. Like, where can people find you on Twitter or on GitHub, or where can people find you? And I think I asked all the questions, so.
Yeah, no, it's all good. Thanks. I had one question for you before I answer all that, which is just like, what was it about? I don't even know how we connected, but like, you know, how did you find me, some random guy, and decide you wanted to talk to me? Was there something about it that interested you?
I think the tweet, so just for everybody listening, like, get on Twitter, because not everybody is going to see this from Twitter, but get on Twitter. That's where a lot of very interesting people are. And one, I don't care like how many followers people have. Like, I just try to find cool people. And I think it was a tweet, Nick McNamara.
Oh, yeah.
I forget how to say his name, but he was Camarada. He was tweeting about how he just had an hour conversation about somebody with neuromodulation, and it was like the smartest conversation he had. And in the lead up to that, I had seen so much like media attention getting on neuromodulation. Like, I've definitely seen a significant increase lately. And I knew that you were interested in that from your bio. And I've been following you for quite a while. I'm not sure, since like 100 followers or something. And I was looking at your profile and you have like 600 now or something, but I'm not sure exactly what prompted me to follow you, but I know what prompted me to reach out was Nick Sweet talking to somebody about neuromodulation. I was like, I messaged you and I was like, this you?
Okay,
and then we started talking and you were like, no, I don't think so. I think I've talked to him for an hour, but it might not have been the smartest conversation. And then we were like, let's do a thread.
People, by the previous hour of us talking, I think everyone will know that whatever I was talking to Nick Camarada about was not intelligent. But I do know Nick very, very loosely. We've talked once. And yes, it's certainly an area that I think is getting a little more attention. So I'm glad for that, for sure.
Yeah, I'm very excited. Yeah, and yeah.
I forgot to shill for myself, which is, everything. I think all my links are just my name.net. So MILAN.CVITKOVIC, which is my hash output looking last name, .net. And then there's links to everything there.
Link your Twitter below as well. But then just kind of like going back to that, like the reason that I wanted to talk to you, like, because you asked, and feel free to ask me other questions too. Like, I want this podcast. So I'm starting this podcast. It's kind of new. I started it. I kind of was like moving around a lot and I dropped it a little bit. And now I really want to pick it back up. And the kind of format that I want is like Joe Rogan or Lex Friedman, like just talking, riffing, not super structured, like not having just 10 questions and then going through those. Like, I just want to like talk to people. But I think a lot of people like get on the podcast circuit and then everybody's kind of heard from them. And not that that's a bad thing. Like, they have interesting ideas, and I'm sure that I'll have those types of people like on my podcast too. But I also want to talk to people that are like researchers, kind of like, or just like people that are lesser known that might have interesting ideas that haven't been as discussed. That's kind of like a format that I want for the podcast. So that's kind of why I was reaching out to you. And I think like, then I can, you know, most people say like, you should do a podcast and only have guests based on like their clout or, you know, their follower count. But luckily I have a decent following on TikTok, so I can like hopefully leverage that into like shining light on other ideas that might not be getting as much discussion. And at the same time, I'll be having bigger people on eventually, I'm sure, but that's kind of my thinking for now.
Nice. Yeah. Well, hopefully I can help you build up your prelude to the big guests.
Yeah, man. Well, thanks for coming on. This was super fun.
Oh, dude, my pleasure. It was great to meet you. And yeah, let me know, answer any more questions or point you towards people who actually have answers.
And if you ever start a startup, definitely reach out. Let me know if anybody's interested in starting a startup, maybe like co-founders might be interested, and then go follow us on Twitter. I guess that's the end.
Yeah. Anyone who's interested in any of the stuff we talked about or who looks at that neuromodulation outline that I wrote and is interested, please do get in touch. I have certainly said enough on this podcast that I'm not an expert in these areas, but I do know a lot of people who are, and I love connecting interested people who are excited to work in the space with people whom they might be able to help. So please get in touch if you have any interest in this area. Yeah, love to connect people.
Awesome. Cool. Thanks, Milan. Or
yeah,
all right. Milan. Awesome. Have a good day.
Talk to you later.
Awesome. So I hope you guys enjoyed that. As always, go follow us on Twitter. Milan is at MWCVITKOVIC, and I am at Nasjack__. And I'd love if you just tweeted any thoughts at us. Let me know how you liked it. And the next podcast will actually be on bioelectricity. I'm super excited for this, and I'll see you guys there. Peace.